At the end of the day on May 5th, 1886, in Bayview, just right outside Milwaukee at the time, before it was incorporated, there were seven dead. It was part of the deadliest day in labor organizing history in the state of Wisconsin. The story behind it and the legacy of it told to us by our next guest. And if you have a question about organized labor in Wisconsin and our history or its legacy, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Here to share the story of the Bayview Rolling Mill tragedy is Jacqueline Kelly, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Labor History Society and a member of OPEIU Local 9 and Workers United Local 122. Jacqueline, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having us on today.
The Wisconsin Labor History Society, it's part of our historical society, isn't it?
Well, we have what's considered an affiliate relationship with the Wisconsin Historical Society. We were founded in 1981 with support from the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, history academics from around the state, and several folks from the Wisconsin Historical Society were directly involved in our founding as well.
What's the importance to the labor history, to Wisconsin's history? What's the connection there as you see it?
Well, I mean, Wisconsin is a state of working people. So when we talk about the struggles of working people in this state, we really are just talking about our own history. Also, the labor movement has done so much to shape our lives. You know, when we talk about our jobs, we're talking about our access to resources, like money to buy the things that we need, to retire with dignity, to have access to health care. And so when we talk about the contributions of labor, we're actually talking about something that has a direct and meaningful impact on people's lives.
When you take us back to 1886, the thing that you just mentioned and listed off and that many of us workers take for granted, those were not available to workers at the time.
No, it was a very different context for people's jobs, their working lives. There was very little in the way, if anything, anything like retirement benefits, you know, access to doctors. And in particular, this struggle that we're going to be chatting about today, the length of their workday, the hours upon hours that they had to work at their jobs.
So what was it like to work in a mill in Milwaukee in the 1880s? What was your life like then?
Well, at this time, people generally worked a 10-hour day, 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. That included Saturday work as well. Certain industries like brewery workers may have even worked even longer, although the brewery workers is a somewhat, perhaps privileged group of workers did enjoy a somewhat leisurely pace of work as well as frequent breaks to enjoy the fruits of their labor.
Were they paid in beer back then?
They weren't. They didn't receive their pay was not in beer. No, they did receive actual money for their work, but they were able to enjoy some drinks along the way.
So May 5th, 1886, leading up to that, there is the national series of events. There is a push for an 8-hour workday, which, again, I think many folks kind of take for granted today. But at the time, these folks, the mill workers, were working 60-hour weeks. What was the movement like in Milwaukee?
Well, here in Milwaukee, it did have sort of a certain character that's not necessarily reflected at the national level. I will say briefly at the national level, the push for this was happening at the national level. And so there were actually two organizations. The Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions first put out a call back in 1884, calling on all their members to push for this nationwide. And then the Knights of Labor, a name that might be a little bit more familiar to folks familiar with history, somewhat grudgingly took up this call. The leader at the national level, the Grand Master Workman, was a man named Terence Powderly, who actually really did not like strikes and boycotts and this sort of more like militant pressure tactics. And so Powderly sort of inherited this push for the 8-hour day from the FOTLU, and he didn't really like it, and instead encouraged their members to write essays on the 8-hour day to be published on Washington's birthday. So as I think folks who are familiar with history may be thinking as well, you know, the history of really any mass movements for justice in this country demonstrate that you do have to apply pressure to powerful people to get what you want. And writing letters to the editor is probably not, It's not going to work. At the local level, there was quite a bit going on here as well. Milwaukee was at the time, particularly in Bayview, was a big ironworking city due to the railroads coming through here. And this call for the 8-hour day was not unfamiliar to Milwaukee working class people. Workers in Milwaukee had pursued this as far back as 1865 with the election of Mayor John J. Talmadge and 1882 with the election of Mayor John M. Stowell, both of which included 8-hour days in their election platforms. A piece of the local context as well. So as I just noted, there were two different organizations at the national level, both working on this. That was reflected at the local level, but there was also a significant amount of conflict within the local labor community. So the Milwaukee Knights of Labor was sort of, you know, the local iteration of this national group. They were led by a man named Robert Schilling. There was another group called the Central Labor Union, which was very, very new. They had just been founded on March 31st, 1886, out of a conflict with the Milwaukee KOL, and as a successor to the almost defunct Milwaukee Trades Assembly. So they only had about 5,300 members, give or take, whereas the local Knights of Labor had like well over 16,000. Mm.
And so was there some dispute between the Milwaukee Knights of Labor and this new upstart Central Labor Union? Were these organized laborers disorganized?
Yeah, I mean, they did come together to fight for the 8-hour day, but they were very different in tactics and philosophy. So the Central Labor Union was led by a fiery German-born socialist named Paul Grotkow, who had been born in Berlin but moved to the United States to actually escape the German anti-socialist law of 1878. So Central Labor Union was a little more radical in orientation. They also did a lot more to organize amongst so-called unskilled workers, which at the time did include a lot of Polish workers, although certainly the Knights had a lot of Polish workers in their ranks as well. The Knights of Labor, to their I guess, credit, were mostly ignoring Grandmaster Workman Terence Powderly's caution in avoiding strikes and boycotts. They were willing to boycott, but they didn't want to strike, basically. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm just the way you set this up, then I think of I think of the story leading up to May 5th, 1886. And I think that what I think it was in the book, The Making of Milwaukee, where, a few days before that, as many as half of the working men of Milwaukee said we're on strike. So this strike did seem to catch fire. There did seem to be a popular uprising here. Oh. And it all seems to be leading to this rolling mill in Bayview.
Yeah. So as I noted, you know, despite their differences in tactics and philosophy, these two organized groups did come together to make sort of a temporary situation specific organization they called the 8-Hour League, which had initially been founded by the Knights of Labor, but did have some delegates from the Central Labor Union. The Central Labor Union, though, over time did take over direction of the league. And so they did come together through this in order to fight for this. So one of the big accomplishments of this 8-hour league was that they did pressure the Milwaukee Common Council to establish an 8-hour day for city workers back in March of 1886, so a couple months before the events of the massacre. And so this was seen as sort of like a wedge, you mm-hmm. know, that if they could accomplish this for this group of workers, sooner or later they could, you know, extend the benefits to privately employed groups of workers as well.
So and these private workers then walk off the job, but isn't mm-hmm. that rolling mill that they end up at on May 5th, 1886 seems to be one of the last operating mills in the midst of all these protests?
Yes. Yeah. So if we think of this as sort of a sequence of events going from May 1st through May 5th, you're correct. By May 1st, one historian estimates that there were 12,000 people out on the streets away from their jobs. So it's probably the closest thing to a general strike we've had so far in Milwaukee. And in fact, at this time, the brewery workers walked out of their jobs as well. Then they actually were not striking for the 8-hour day. They were in a separate conflict with their employers, and they just decided, you know what, we're out too. And so they joined the ranks out in the streets.
And that means that the police were outnumbered, which would probably explain why the governor would call in the state militia.
Yeah, well, they did. Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. So actually, Governor Rusk came to Milwaukee.
It's
He arrived
Jeremiah
in
Rusk. So he is,
Yes.
he's not in Milwaukee, but then the protesters take to the streets. So he's like, I should be there.
Yeah. Yep, he came to Milwaukee. Probably it was on either Sunday, May 2nd or Monday, May 3rd. Initially, the local leadership in Milwaukee, by which I mean Mayor Emil Wahlberg and Sheriff George Passion, felt that they could handle the situation without state-level support. But eventually, by Tuesday, May 4th, the state and county put in a request to the governor, and they sent in many units from other places in Wisconsin. And so by the evening of Tuesday, May 4th, there were about 800 guardsmen in Milwaukee.
But that still would pale in comparison to the protesters. And when you get to May 5th, the count that I've seen is about 1,500 protesters facing off against 800 militia members. And this is, were they all around this Bayview rolling mill because it's the one that's operating and they need to keep it open?
Yes. Well, I mean, obviously the employer wished to keep it open. The workers in the community wished it to be closed. And it was basically the last one standing in the area.
Why was this
Robert
one
Ozen.
standing? Why was the rolling mill left open when the other ones had workers walk off? Do we know?
Well, the workers there had like mostly walked off, but they had sort of a skeleton crew that managed to keep it open. And the owner of the rolling mill, I guess, was just a little more obstinate than one of the other close to last holdouts was Edward P. Alice of the Reliance Works, which that name is certainly familiar to
Yes.
Wisconsin audiences of West Allis. And it's also interesting because the Alice Chalmers Company figures very large in Wisconsin labor history going into the 20th century as well. So that's a separate story that we don't have time to get into right now. But yeah, Alice was a big deal in Wisconsin labor history.
So May 5th, 1886, 1,500 protesters are marching towards the Bayview Rolling Mill, surrounded by 800 state militia. Was it chaos? What ensued? Did the governor give the order to shoot? How did the violence begin?
Yeah, well, the crowd, so different historians give like different numbers, but you are more or less correct at 1,500. Robert Ozen says 1,000. Bernhard C. Korn and Robert Nesbitt both say 1,500. They were marching from St. Stanislaus, which was a big Catholic parish on Milwaukee's southeast side that served as sort of a, community gathering place for the local Polish community. And this gathering place and the fact that there were so many Polish ethnics involved in this actually was part of what made this such a sad and difficult situation. So as I noted, the state militia had been called this, and that included several, groups within the militia. One of those groups was the Kosciuszko Guard, which was made up mostly of Polish like middle class business people. And they actually met in the parish school at St. Stanislaus. So when the Kosciuszko Guard showed up the day before on May 4th, this caused a huge issue. I mean, a lot of people in the crowd were very upset, hollering at what they viewed as their countrymen who were there working against them, throwing rocks at them. And it caused so much agitation amongst the soldiers that they did discharge their weapons on May 4th. They shot over their heads and no one was harmed. But they became so sort of agitated and frustrated that they shot over their heads prior to actually shooting into the crowd on May 5th.
Did the governor give the order to shoot?
He sure did. He wasn't present personally, but they called him on the telephone and he gave the order, "Very well, sir, fire on them."
The argument from the protesters, and I think it was quoted as 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours of what we will, which
Yes.
was a pretty good slogan. I'm always kind of wondered what the other side's argument was, that we can't afford to have you have 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours of what you will. What's the counter to the protesters?
Well, I can tell you that there had been a confrontation at the rolling mill, as I said, the day before on May 4th. And folks like Robert Schilling and a committee of workers had been in conference with the plant manager, John C. Parks. And his claim, specific, I suppose, to that industry, was that the 8-hour day was just somehow not applicable to mill work, which is, I guess, sort of just sort of pretending like this is something that just happens, like the rising of the sun and the rolling of the tides, that it just somehow doesn't apply.
This is here, the way it is. Always, this is the
it's
way.
It's just the way it is, guys. You guys just have to accept it and work till you drop.
Jacqueline yeah. Kelly is our guest, executive director of the Wisconsin Labor History Society, talking about the Bayview Rolling Mill tragedy of May 5th, 1886, that left seven dead, including a 12-year-old boy. And so if you've got a question, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or talk at WPR.org. So the governor gives the order to fire, and this time, on this day, a day later, the militia fires into the crowd, and I imagine that the crowd scatters except for the seven bodies on the ground. What's the immediate aftermath of this violence?
Well, you know, the violence accomplished what it was meant to, which was to create chaos and disorder and fear amongst the populace. As you note, there were several deaths. I will just say briefly that it is, you know, John Goethe takes the position, and I think with the society, we would agree with this as well. It's difficult to know exactly how many passed. The newspapers at the time give a number of nine. But trying to corroborate that with death certificates is difficult. Some historians give a number as low as five. I can tell you that several of the names that frequently pop up as different historians have examined this question are Michael Ruchakis, Francis Kunkel, Johann Mazka, except Johann Mazka might have actually been John Marsh. That will probably forever be a mystery. Martin Jankowicz, Robert Erdman, Frank Nowarczyk, and Albert Erdman. Now, Frank was the boy you mentioned, and yeah. It really was a tragic thing. He was a schoolboy, and he literally fell on his school books as he was walking around outside. So really a tragic thing.
In the long-term ramifications of this day, I mean, we can sit here today and say that we have an 8-hour work day today that was part of a national movement that was adopted eventually, regardless of what the mill operator had to tell the protesters before that. But there's also the history of socialism in Milwaukee that seems to have come after that. And I just saw this as well, that Bayview became incorporated into Milwaukee just a year after the shooting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There were a lot of repercussions locally and nationally. The labor movement did not accomplish the 8-hour day as it hoped to in 1886. But in the wake of the national push in 1886, the Knights of Labor sort of disintegrated for a variety of reasons, one of which perhaps of interest to Milwaukee audiences is that their leader, Grandmaster Workman Terence Powderly, was a committed prohibitionist. And so all the brewery workers were like, we're out. That's not going to work for us. And it's right kind of around the time that Knights of Labor falling apart, that federation I mentioned earlier was not very strong to begin with. Towards the end of the year of 1886, the AFL starts to come together and pick up all those scattered pieces. And the AFL continued to pursue this, although it was not accomplished actually until the Roosevelt administration. Locally, there was a lot of fallout from this. As you can imagine, within the Polish community, the situation was quite ugly. As I mentioned, several of the members of the Kosciuszko Guard were sort of like middle-class business people type. Many of them had their businesses close to ruined due to sort of informal boycotts amongst the community. Legally, locally, a coroner's jury actually praised the militia and returned no indictments for them shooting into the crowd. But several folks from the labor side were charged with a variety of charges. The stiffest sentence came to Central Labor Union leader Paul Grotkow, who was sentenced to a year in jail, although he used his time wisely and ran for mayor from jail.
Did he win?
Yes. No. No, he did not.
And vote for me. I'm in jail.
Yeah, he didn't serve the full year. It was actually only a couple months.
Okay.
But it did create a turn to political action amongst Milwaukee's and Wisconsin's labor community. What was left of the Knights of Labor pursued a People's Party that actually got successfully several people elected, including a full slate in Milwaukee County, although this actually is related to the charges against Paul Gradkow, because the district attorney at the time was able to get a lot of the charges against Robert Schilling and other Knights of Labor folks dismissed. Gradkow got a year in jail. And I can't verify if this is true or not, but Paul Gradkow always blamed Robert Schilling for that.
Oh, wow.
He always felt that there had been sort of a connection between Robert Schilling and the Knights of Labor and this district attorney that was elected, and he personally blamed Robert Schilling. So they managed to unite enough to get through the November elections, and then right after that was when Paul Gradkow was sentenced, and clearly after that their relationship was, it wasn't super strong to begin with, but it was pretty much done by then.
Let's go to Rick in Madison now. Rick, hi.
Hi. I'm a labor historian also, and first I want to say how much I appreciate your guest today and the accuracy of her comments and the level of sophistication. It's really marvelous. About 20 years ago, I published the Historical Society published my book, A City at War, Milwaukee Labor During World War II. And I tried to answer the question, why, if we were more unified then than ever before or since, is there still labor conflict? And the answer is because business and labor don't have identical interests. I'd like your guest to comment about the importance, the way in which history informs the need and the importance of organizing and of organized labor. I'll get off the phone and listen.
Rick, thank you for the call. Jacqueline?
Well, first off, Rick, certainly thank you for calling in. And I have read your book, so it's really nice to hear from you here. All right, so the question was the importance of history and sort of organizing today and everything.
Yeah.
So I think a big piece of that is that the way we understand the past informs the way we understand the present. And that is really part of why the Labor History Society was founded. A big part of our mission is getting labor story into Wisconsin schools and colleges. And so, you know, a lot of the history we receive in school or sometimes in popular media like the History Channel, it does tend to sort of leap from like powerful businessman to powerful businessman. And a study of labor history helps us understand that organizing is not only possible, it is an effective way to improve your life. That regular people, by coming together through structures like unions, can actually meaningfully impact their lives and the lives of people that come after them and make them better. So that's just a quick answer, I think, to Rick's question.
That these magnates weren't the ones responsible for 8-hour workdays, for weekends, for the opportunity for retirement and affordable health care.
The big thing, I think, this story teaches us a couple different things. But one of the big ones is that any benefits we enjoy in the workplace, they are not gifts from benevolent management. Truly, they were fought and died for by working people who came before us.
And the deadliest battle in Wisconsin would have been May 5th, 1886. And regardless of how many dead there, this was a strike that actually struck the conscience of the Milwaukee community. And there was a result, you know, there were ramifications thereafter, some political, some social, and some that you would say probably still reverberate to this day.
Yeah, I believe so. We put on our annual event every year, which the most recent socialist mayor of Milwaukee, Frank Zeiler, was a great supporter of. And it's a really special event. We enjoy a lot of support from the Milwaukee Area Labor Council, Bayview Historical Society, and of course, as always, the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. And at this point, we've been doing this for 40 years, and we typically have well over 200 people who come together every year in this sort of very deeply felt ritual of remembrance of these people who lost their lives.
I know it's a little bit early, but I probably won't talk to you in a couple of weeks. So Jacqueline, I'll say now, happy Labor Day, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you. Happy Labor Day to you and your audiences.
Jacqueline Kelly, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Labor History Society, joining us to take a look at the May 5th, 1886 tragedy that took place at the Bayview Rolling Mill. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News.